Welcome to the Woodridge Baptist Church podcast. For more information about what's happening in the life of our church, visit our website at www.woodridge.org. Enjoy the podcast.
And we are back at it, back into Revelation chapters 13, verse 11. Starting there today, we'll be talking about the beast from the earth. Last time we met, it was the beast from the sea, and we got to deal with all that sort of fun stuff. And now we need to continue that conversation midway through chapter 13 and with the second beast. It is just as much fun as the last, as we will see here. And we must continue as we go through this to look at this from the context of the socio-political time in which John lived. We know that the first beast represented Rome and all of those who are worshiping Rome, and this new beast, or the second beast, seems to represent the imperial priesthood. This is the group that assisted Rome in growing the imperial cult throughout all of Rome. They are the priests for the Roman emperors, I guess is probably a good way to look at it. So the imperial priesthood, so the imperial being the Roman emperors and all of their emperor ways, and the priest who would show people how to worship and then maintain the temples and altars that were built for these emperors. Though we can look at this in the context that John lived, we can also look into the future that the devil or Satan or the accuser, depending on which translation you're looking at and which Greek word you're wanting to use, will use, for the most part, secular powers and influences, so governments of the world, systems of the world, to deceive the people of the world, and use every method available to gain worship of the inhabitants of those who exist here on the planet at that time. So a lot going on with that. Let's begin here in verse 11. I'm going to read the rest from 11 through 18, which is the rest of chapter 13, and then we will jump into 14, and most likely, as we look into chapter 14, I will assume, we'll probably go to verse 13 there of chapter 14, just because it kind of depends on how long this takes to get to that point, but I would assume that's the direction we'll go. So as we're going along here, and as we read along and see what we have going on and are very interested and intrigued by the writings of John here in Revelation 13, he writes here in verse 11, "Then I saw another beast coming up out of the earth, and he had two horns like a lamb, and he spoke as a dragon. He exercises all the authority of the first beast in his presence, and he makes the earth and those who dwell in it to worship the first beast whose fatal wound was healed." You can kind of see how this is working here, with this being the imperial priest forcing those here on earth to worship the Roman emperors. More details here in a second. "He performs great signs so that he even makes fire come down out of heaven to the earth in the presence of men, and he deceives those who dwell on the earth because of the signs which was given to him to perform in the presence of the beast, telling those who dwell on the earth to make an image to the beast who had the wound of the sword and had come to life. And it was given to him to give breath to the image of the beast, so that the image of the beast would even speak and cause as many as do not worship the image of the beast to be killed." There's a lot going on right there. "And he causes all, the small and the great, the rich and the poor, and the free men and the slaves, to be given a mark on their right hand or on their foreheads. And he provides that no one will be able to buy or sell except the one who has the mark, either the name of the beast or the number of his name. Here is wisdom. Let him who has understanding calculate the number of the beast, for the number is that of a man, and his number is 666. We'll get into that, what that looks like here, but names and numbers a lot of times tied in together, and numbers were used for letters and vice versa, and it's very interesting how that played out. So that's where we are with our new friend, the beast from the earth. It was a tradition in the ancient times of the two beasts to have one from the water and one from the land. You'll see other stories where you have beasts of the water and beasts of the land coming together and either fighting each other or joining together to fight humans or other beings. And so this isn't something that would be very foreign at all to those in this time period who are reading this as an apocrypha type, not apocrypha. I don't even know if I can say that word right now, as this type of literature. What John is speaking here is not strange for the early readers. If we were to reference First Enoch in the Apocrypha, chapter 60, verses 7 through 10, we would know of the Leviathan. We've also heard of that, of course, in our own scriptures, which is a female monster who lived in the ocean, and then Behemoth, a male monster who occupied a waste of wilderness, a land called Duodane. This, like I said, would not be foreign to them. What John is doing here is not odd and would make sense for authors to pick up stories from common culture, which John does. John picks up a lot of stories, especially from the Old Testament, and even meshes some of the prophetic-like stories that you'd get from Daniel and some of the other prophets, Ezekiel, and kind of mesh it up to provide us with what he is trying to communicate to the people at that time. So nothing too odd in that regard. Another way to look at this, that the two beasts would be determined, is based on another familiar story, like I said, from the book of Daniel, most likely chapter 7. The first beast came from the sea, and we talked about that last week, and the second beast out of the earth, as we see in Daniel chapter 7, verse 17, where it says, the beasts are kings that arise out of the earth. Another way to look at this is as the two beasts, again, like last week, last time we talked about this, the first beast, Rome, came across the Mediterranean to conquer Asia Minor, which we know that to be historically true, and the second beast rose within Asia Minor itself. So once Rome was established, its power in Asia Minor, the second beast arose, of course, being the imperial priest. What we know is that the evil trinity is now together, the evil trinity being the beast of the land, the beast of the earth, and Satan. And so you have that coming together here, wreaking havoc on all of the world. We can contrast here, of course, with Christ received authority from the Father. The Antichrist receives authority from the dragon. So you have dragon, beast, earth beast, ocean beast, earth beast. And then you have, of course, Father, Son, Holy Spirit, the contrast of the Holy Trinity versus the evil Trinity. Continuing as the Holy Spirit glorifies Christ, the false prophet, the third beast, glorifies the Antichrist. So again, some similarities there. We know that the beast out of the land has a couple of descriptions, one being the deceiver and another known as a false prophet. The symbolism of the horns like a lamb are to give a false sense of security of being harmless, when in fact this beast is absolutely not harmless, though. It's like a sheep in wolf's clothing. We've heard of that before. Much like when Jesus, of course, would warn of the false prophets when he did make that reference to sheep's clothing. The speaking like or as could mean that the beast had the roar of a dragon or spoke like a dragon, much like we see with the serpent in the Garden of Eden having words of deceit. So we know there is a serpent, an accuser in the Garden of Eden who used words of deception. And that's similar to what we're seeing here as well. The second beast is fulfilling a priestly role with the intent of people worshiping the first beast. And through this, he works miracles and threatens economic turmoil to those who do not worship the beast out of the sea. Of course, that being Rome. In John's day, the second beast could either be, like I was saying earlier, either local priest of the imperial cult or the more powerful provincial council of that time responsible for enforcing emperor worship. So you had multiple groups of powerful people who had been given power to enforce the worshiping of the emperor. So it was a big deal. Keep everyone in line. You worship the emperor and everyone stays in line and we're all good and staying out of trouble for the most part. It seems to be John's opinion that Rome and emperor worship were the primary reason of the church's oppression and suffering, which is, of course, a major reason why John wrote the book of Revelation. Pergamum at that time, which was one of the primary areas of the emperor cult or the imperial cult, had already martyred believers, including Antipas. So if we would go back to chapter 2, verse 13 of Revelation, you'll see that. There's something deeper going on here beyond the time of Roman power. It seems that John is showing a secular structure that is being built or created that distracts people from God and the worship of God to the worship of secular systems and institutions, which would then, of course, play in our day. That's what we're seeing, where there's a lot of distractions from God related to secular systems, be they governments, be they other sort of institutions that are in the way that either people worship or put a lot of authority into, and even to over the power of an authority of God. Let's continue on. Verse 12, as we go through here, the second beast, and these other verses, trust me, will not be as long as 11. There'll be some of length, but we'll go through the next very quickly. The second beast works as a prophet for the first to carry out the message of its God. The purpose of the second beast is to point everyone to the first beast. Of course, like I said, to worship that beast is what we're seeing in verse 12. This is the entire human race, not just those who are not faithful, but all people. We have to remember that the God had promised that that those who are faithful would be protected spiritually, which is true, but they would not, that promise of protection for material or physical protection is not part of the deal. It's about spiritual, but being able to remain faithful even in a time like this. The fatal wound here that is being referenced could be a reference to Nero Redivivus, and how this emperor was the head that was fatally wounded. We again see that it was the beast that healed and not the head, so most likely that very likely could be that one emperor there. Could be something else, but you know, we only have so much time to go through this. Verse 13, the false prophet parody continues here. Seems to be a parody of the work of Elijah. This is based on the false prophet's ability to perform miracles or great signs. Deuteronomy 13:1 warns of such false prophet misleading those who see wonderful and spectacular signs. Continuing with Elijah, like Elijah, he comes down from heaven in the sight of everyone, so he's kind of mocking, not mocking, but copying, of course, the work that Elijah did, because people would be familiar with that. As Elijah helped or showed the way for the Messiah, the false prophet does the same for the false Messiah. Shows, you know, oh, look how powerful this false Messiah is. We can do tricks. We can do miracles. Look at us. And so it would, and of course, people, and being who we are as people, we get really enamored and excited about things that are neat and new, and will sometimes want to distract us, and we will follow those instead of who we're supposed to follow or live the way we are called to live. Jesus predicted in Mark 13, chapter 13, verse 22, that the false prophet would lead people astray, even those who were faithful. And Paul gives a familiar warning or a similar warning in 2 Thessalonians 2:9, where there will be a false teachers, prophets who display counterfeit miracles, signs, and wonders. Man, who has the yawns today? It is me. Anyways, trying to get that oxygen into the brain. Verse 14, continue on here. Certainly I'm not bored by this, but certainly, I guess, with all the talking and thinking, my brain is deprived of oxygen. So we will do our best to continue on. Verse 14, we can look at the false prophet here as the Antichrist. You could refer to him as, say, the minister of propaganda. That's a good way to look at it. You'd hate to have, I would not want to have that title, but I assume plenty of people in other governments in the past have, and even to this day, would I would say there are ministers of propaganda. So that's what we have here. A different audience, possibly less broad here, with the inhabitants of the earth or dwell on the earth, seems to be, this is the group for unregenerated humanity that's being referred to here, those whose names are not written in the book, in the Lamb's Book of Life. And so you have a couple different groups being referred to here. So we'll look at it from that perspective. This group here is being deceived by the miracles that the second beast performs. The second beast in this situation instructs the people following along to make an image of the first beast, of the beast who survived the stroke of the sword. Based on what we know from historical texts, of course, this is just, again, high-level overview. The Roman Empire had set up an image of the emperor in every city, and that image was to be worshipped. And so that's what is being talked about here, and about how in every city now in Asia Minor or any Roman provinces now had the statues of emperors that they then had to worship, which is just very unfortunate if you're just a guy walking down the street or gal walking down the street and seeing that, oh gosh, I walk by this, now do I have to worship it? And the answer was probably yes. If I don't, what happens? Well, I probably won't be able to eat. It's really a very, very hard time for the people. Happens today, to this very point. I mean, stories on North Korea I was reading today related to freedom of religion. I was dealing with this very issue. Not that John is pointing to North Korea and the beast being North Korea or China or Russia, but that people live in similar situations of oppression as they had underneath the Roman Empire. Verse 15, the second beast seems to be able to have the power to breathe life into inanimate images or statues even that have been put up throughout all of Rome. Remember, the second beast is a counterpart to the Holy Ghost, so has some sort of breath or ability to do that. Some people say it was purely smoke and mirrors. Could have been or can be, and it just depends. But it seems like what John is describing here is the ability to do that, to put some sort of life in inanimate objects. It is widely believed in ancient literature that statues spoke and performed miracles. We recall that Simon Magus was able to bring statues to life. So it would not be out of the ordinary. But again, probably a lot of ventriloquism, which was practiced by priests in Oriental cults, and also some related sorcery had found a place in the official circles of Rome during that time. So it probably had a lot to do with that as well. A lot of just sleight of hand, ventriloquism, Wizard of Oz type stuff that we see. It seems based on the syntax that the image statue not only spoke, but it could also pass the death sentence on all who would not worship it. Again, tied to that ventriloquism idea. What we're seeing is that there will be a significant division. We will have those who will stay to their faith and others who will venture off and worship the Antichrist, which unfortunately has happened since the beginning of worship. This is a decision that all people have to make preceding the return of Christ, as we know from 2 Thessalonians 2. This is believed to be where we will see the separation of half-hearted Christians and those who remain faithful to God. At this point in history, this is how it was playing out in the time of the Emperor Trajan. Failure to worship him, his image, was a capital offense, and you had better be all in if you expected to survive. It's kind of the theory and philosophy of that time period. As we continue on, I told you we were moving so fast here, you're probably getting whiplash. Verse 16, at this point, all of human society is now required to receive the mark of the first beast on either their right hand or the forehead. It was a sign for commerce, the ability to buy and sell things. So if you wanted to buy or sell things, you had to have some sort of marking. The only way to carry out, like I said, the normal pursuits of daily life would require this mark. There are many thoughts on the origin of this mark. One thought is that it could be like a brand given to slaves or soldiers that were defeated in battle, which was typical for that time, that you'd slay, you would the winning party or country or emperor would put his brand on slaves or soldiers who lost. For example, the Samians branded the defeated Athenian army or prisoners with an owl. Could be worse, but still bad. Religious tattooing and branding was a common practice for the religion of that day to show which god they were to be devoted to. So it would not be out of the ordinary to have some sort of tattoo, a little stick and poke of an owl, or you name it, Artemis, or a brand of the same could be something that would be someone people would be common to. It's almost like, it's certainly not like tattoos today, but I mean, I guess you could look at tattoos and you put a tattoo because it has some sort of meaning, but this is significantly more worship-like or idolatry of what is going on here. Jews were branded by Ptolemy Philopater when they submitted to registration with the ivy leaf. So an ivy leaf, an owl, you know. This would be the mark of Dionysiac worship, so that god would be something that would be worshipped based on that, or they would think that's what you were worshipping. Another could be an apocalyptic description of certificates issued to those who fulfill their obligations of emperor worship. So you worship the emperor, and so you get a certificate of completion that you did that, and so you kind of carry it around, kind of like a vaccine card you could carry around. Just kidding, not the same thing. Anyways, one more could be a parody against the mark of Christ, which is X in Greek. The mark on the forehead was given to Christians when they became new believers, which is Merry Xmas, Christmas. Some people think that Merry Xmas is not good or not nice or not Christian, but actually you're just saying it in Greek, so you're just actually being fancy when you say Merry Xmas because you're saying it in ancient Greece, Greek. Whatever the mark was, it's in, and I think it's funny for those who think that they're taking Christ out of Christmas, but they're actually not. They're just inserting it, but in the Greek language. Whatever the mark was, its intent was to be a parody against the sealing of the servants of God that we saw back in chapter 7. If you remember the 144,000 sealed, this is supposed to be a, okay, well, you'll do that, we'll do this. And so that's kind of what's a tit for tat. Much like those who receive the seal of God would escape the destruction that will come to the earth, those who accept the mark of the beast will escape the beast's wrath against the church. So the beast is going to show its wrath against the church. So you either take the mark and avoid the wrath, or you don't take the mark and you deal with the wrath. But at the same time, the positive side is you avoid the destruction that's going to come to the earth. And most likely, if you're, well, not most likely, but when, if and when you are martyred, you are in paradise with God versus not. Unlike the seal of God, the seal of the beast seems to be invisible and shows the allegiance of the demands of the imperial cult. Some have taken it as less of a physical mark and more of a figurative meaning to show the character and conduct of the idolater. So that's could be that's just the fruit in which they produce as people, as their personalities would produce. It's a bit weak based on the need of the mark to buy and sell things. So you just because you were a pagan-like guy, and now you can buy things, I think I agree, is a little weak. There had to be some sort of identifier there to let them know whose side you were on. And so what we see here is that at the end of this, is before we go into verse 17, only those who are willing to die compromise their faith will resist the mark of the Antichrist. And we continue on. Verse 17. We're almost two verses out, and we're to verse chapter 14. So the mark not only shows allegiance to the beast, it also allows, like I said, for people to buy and sell things, to have commerce, to have daily activities with their lives, to be able to go to Starbucks, you name it. This seems to be more of a harassment of believers and just killing them off. And so now we're just going to starve you to death if you don't accept this and you can't have your Frappuccino. The mark here is identified as the name of the beast written in its numerical equivalent. It is not the name of the beast or the number of his name that is stamped on followers. The mark is the number of the name. That's not confusing. So in this time period, letters of the alphabet served as numbers, and the first nine letters represented numbers 1 through 9. As there were not enough letters in the then current Greek alphabet, certain obsolete letters and signs were brought into the system. So based on this very name, every name yielded some sort of number. So odd. There is a lot more to cryptograms, but that is for another day. But that's what we're dealing with, is a cryptogram. I think we'll talk about a little bit more here in a second, but that's what it is. And it doesn't call in the devil if you write 666 somewhere or do weird satanic things. It's just a name of a name. And we'll get more into that here in a second, because I know we will in verse 18. Now that is a verse that has, this is a verse that has opened up a lot of cans with a lot of worms. Verse 18, there's little consensus on the interpretation of what John had in mind when he talks about this and the number that he is to give. It seems what is being said that the person who has understanding is called upon to calculate the number of the beast. With the number we have here and the practice of Gematria, we are to work backwards to determine what name is 666. This was typical to use such numbers in apocalyptic literature. It seems here that the number of the beast is the name of a certain man, not the number of man, but a man, of a man, possibly to a historical person, as shown if you were to have the translation of the NRSV. New Revised Standard is what that is. There are so many options that have been tried that we really don't have time to go into all of them, but I'll give you a few. The church father Irenaeus, who lived in Asia Minor, said it could have been the Roman Empire of Latinos or Teuton, the titans of Greek mythology who rebelled against the gods. So that could be what they're referring to here. Some have said that it could be initials of all the Roman emperors, but got to get that number. To get to that number, you have to delete Otho and Vitellius, and I think they'd be offended if they were deleted from the Roman Emperor, so we can't do that. Some say it was a reference to Domitian and his full Latin title, which I didn't spell it out, but it's quite long, and that could be it. Another solution is that the 666 is a triangular number of 36, and 36 is a triangular number of 8, which is the number of the Antichrist. I don't know. It could be that. It's one of those things. Well, we don't really know, and it doesn't really matter. But it's a mark that's going to be put on or identify people possibly did at that time of people who are not able to participate fully in society. Today, it seems the more commonly accepted idea is that it's the numerical equivalent to Nero Caesar. This is also goes along with some translation variant of 616 would give the same name if it was written in Latin. So I've seen that multiple times where maybe the number wasn't 666, it was 616, and it was misinterpreted. And if it was 616, it also gives you the name of Caligula, so that could be part of it as well. Then again, the name of Nero was never suggested by ancient commentators, even though his level of persecution modeled him as a good antichrist. He was not a pleasant person to be around if you worshiped God. More recent views is that the 666 is more of a symbol than a cryptogram. Oh, well. So it may not even be a cryptogram, you say. As it falls short of the number of perfection in each of its digits, meaning it shows us that it is the ongoing inability of the beast to accomplish its purpose. So we know that if the number 7 is complete perfection, complete or perfection. Yeah, I guess it could be complete perfection. Is that redundant? It could be. Anyways, what we're seeing here is that the 666 is showing that it's not quite there. Doesn't quite hit the mark. It's not the number related to what we know of as God. What we can determine, or at least possibly agree, is that John most likely only expected or wanted those closest to him to know what the number really meant. Otherwise, he probably would have explained that to them if they didn't know. Anyways, that's chapter 13. Are we excited? And we were well over halfway done with Revelation, and nothing serious has happened to anyone, as in no one has a mark anywhere that I'm aware of. Maybe you got a vaccination, but that's nothing wrong with that. Anyways, all right, as we go on here, chapter 14. Revelation 14, the Lamb and the 144,000 on Mount Zion. We get reintroduced to the 144,000 sealed folks that I believe we saw in chapter 7. And this is just, man, blow your mind, crazy, crazy stuff going on here. So we have a slight change in direction. You can even call it an interlude. From the dire predictions of the future to a pause where the author offers hope to those who remain steadfast and faithful to God. John moves quickly on from the storm to a new and bright morning where for eternity the Lamb and his followers stand on the holy mountain of Zion with redemption in the air. The holy mountain of Zion here being actually in heaven or not on earth. The first five verses seem to be the most enigmatic. In the entire book of Revelation, it is a very mysterious, very difficult piece of text to interpret, but it's why we do this. For example, the usage of virgin typically depicts girls, young girls specifically, who are sexually innocent, and here the author writes about virgins who have not defiled themselves with women. Well, I'm not sure if he was talking about the lesbian culture of the time, but I don't think he was. And so that's, look at this, it's quite a paradox that we'll be working through. We also are trying to figure out who those are who are marked are exactly. We know them from the sealer of the mark from chapter 7, and then we learned about the mark of the beast from chapter 13, where we just finished up. Both marks bring in the name of the one who is being followed. Seemingly the destiny of each is determined by the mark they bear or they decide to take. Each person will have their choice on which. So, and of course, their destiny will be determined. So it is quite the deal. Like I said, it is an enigma, these first chapters. Let's see here. Let's just read 1 through 5. Yeah. 1 through 5, and then we'll do a little disco on that, and then go on from there. Chapter 14. Then I looked, and behold, the Lamb was standing on Mount Zion with him 144,000 having his name and the name of his Father written on their foreheads. And I heard a voice from heaven, like the sound of many waters, and like the sound of loud thunder. And the voice of which I heard was like the sound of harpists playing on their hearts. Remember, look at all these likes again. And they sang a new song before the throne and before the four living creatures. Hey, the four living creatures are back. And the elders, hey, they're back too. And no one could learn the song except the 144,000 who had been purchased from the earth. And so these are not angels or elders singing at this point. These are people who once lived on the earth. These are the ones who have not been defiled with women, for they have kept themselves chaste. These are the ones who follow the Lamb wherever he goes. These have been purchased from among men as the first fruits of God and to the Lamb, and no lie was found in their mouth. They are blameless. Very interesting that he would refer to them this way. Da-da. Just looking at this other translation, I think that they're pretty consistent here. I just want to make sure it's a little bit different, but not too different. All right. So based on how this vision opens up here, it seems to be very clear what Mark is witnessing. So he's looking at the 144,000, most likely returning from the chapter 7, and we now have the Lamb joining them, Lamb, of course, being the Christ. It seems we have a contrast here with those of chapter 13 who have the mark of the beast on their hands and foreheads. We have followed the Lamb from chapter 5, first as being the one who came up, who can open up the original sealed document that we talked about, the sealed scroll, and in chapter 7 received significant amounts of praise from the heavenly multitudes, and now here in chapter 14 standing in victory with his followers. So the Lamb, being still quite the popular fellow, is continuing on, and that would make, of course, a lot of sense based on who the Lamb is. This is a very Jewish vision. When looking at them standing on Mount Zion, as is believed by Jews, that the Messiah will appear with a great multitude on Mount Zion. If you were to look at 2 Esdras chapter 13, you will see that reference point being made there. So, of course, John, being Jewish himself, is bringing in a lot of Jewish tradition and context. So let's not be surprised here whenever he uses Jewish symbolism to do this. Mount Zion, as we know, is known for the place of divine deliverance. For instance, the prophet Joel said to those who were on Mount Zion, on the day of the Lord would be spared. So those Jews who made it to Mount Zion on the day of the Lord would be spared, was the idea. In this case, however, it seems that Mount Zion that John is referring to is not the earthly version, but a heavenly one. The Jerusalem is the one that is above, as referenced in Galatians 4:26. We can take it a bit further as a representation. Probably makes more sense. A Mount Zion, it is not a geographic location, but a symbol of persevering and conquering church, of a church that is persevering and conquering, evil. some have tried to force this into an earthly site, but that seems to be an exegesis forced into a prior interpretive mold, so let's not do that. And let's try to look at this from, or as best as we can, for knowing what we know, the perspective of John here. It's hard enough the 144,000 are here the same as the ones in chapter 7. It seems what we will see in verse 4, they seem to be set apart from almost as a group of super saints. I think that's such a thing. They seem to be the first fruits, and if they are truly celibate, that would seemingly enjoy a privileged relationship, which was a belief of, as we know, Paul. And many Jewish people of that time. Probably even argue many Gentiles believe that as well. But we know for sure Paul did, because he talked about it. It is difficult to know if they are not the first 144,000, because there's no article, as it doesn't say the 144,000, as you see there. It says, except the 140, oh, it actually does right there. No, not in the same way. So if you look verse 1, and with him 144,000. Yeah, so it doesn't use an article of the, so hard to say if it is the from chapter 7. Maybe that's just too much detail. As we will dig deeper in verses 3 and 5, we can note that most likely they are all of those who have been redeemed, so all people who have been redeemed. From chapter 7, the 144,000 were those who had been sealed against the woes that lay ahead of them. Now it seems that the 144,000 have already passed through this ordeal. It could be assumed that the use of the same number is not to show it's the exact same group, but to instead say that no one was lost through the valley of despair. So through the ordeal of these beasts and the marks in which they were acquired, everyone, all those who were faithful, all those who had been redeemed, made it through. What we can take from both this and chapter 7 is that the 144,000 is the innumerable multitude, which represents all those who have been redeemed throughout human history, which, well, stays pretty consistent with what we've been talking about up to this point. They all bear the symbol of the Lamb and of the Father. It was known in the ancient world that a mark such as this would typically stand for five different things: ownership, loyalty, security, dependence, and safety. All five would make sense regarding the Lamb and the Father, and would not make a whole lot of sense regarding the Antichrist. So that was verse 1. Verses 2 and 3, because we like to move through this efficiently and effectively. From seeing the vision, we now see that John heard what was going on in the vision as well. He is hearing a new song by those who have been redeemed. That's good. Similar to Ezekiel's sound imagery or song imagery, the roaring waters is similar to what we heard when the winged cherubim were in flight in Ezekiel chapter 1. We can think of it as being like a voice of God, or like the voice of God, not a voice, the voice of God approaching. Gotta get our articles right. It must have been quite the sound based on the amount of descriptions he puts into this, both that of thunder and harpist. What is different from other songs is that this is not an angelic choir singing. Instead, it is the song of the redeemed multitude, which is completely different from the angels and elders and heavenly hosts worshiping earlier on. Unlike angels, and the reason this is unlike angels, only the redeemed have been delivered, and thus only they can sing these types of songs because they've been delivered. Angels haven't been delivered because angels have always kind of been there doing their thing. Same with the elders. So it's like, we've been redeemed, let's sing a song. And that's what's happening here of those humans. This seems to be the new song that we know of from chapter 5, verse 9. And now it is being sung by those who have been purchased by the blood of the Lamb. Now they stand before the throne as a group of heavenly priests. As we continue on here, heavenly priests. So you can see that as the heavenly priests that we see here are in contrast to the imperial priests from just a little while ago. I don't know if he intended to do that, but you can kind of just see what's going on here. Just like what we see in Psalms regarding new songs, this is based on deliverance, but only those who remain steadfast have been delivered and can sing this song. Though the angels and the elders are not singing along, they are, of course, seemingly there watching. As this time being redeemed from the earth does not mean a bodily removal, instead they have been removed from the evil ways of the world. So John continues to show how the separation of good and evil with those who are and remain faithful. Verse 4, we have learned a bit more about the 144,000. They are virgins who have not defiled themselves with women, followers of the Lamb, and the first fruits purchased from among humankind. As you can imagine, the first description has led to quite a bit of conversation, and consternation. I used that word just a while back. It's a good word. Some commentators take this to mean that the 144,000 are super elite, like I said, super saints, believers who sustained from sexual encounters, kind of like what Paul used to talk about. Some would say that John believed that those who never married in the ancient culture were held at a higher godly ideal than those who were married, similar to what Paul thought. This seems a bit counter to other parts of Scripture, kind of what Paul taught. They are celibate and virgins, which is, in some cases, the use of the word virgin is also used for men who remain pure from sexual encounters. So in most cases, like I said, virgin typically meant a young girl who had not had sexual encounters. In this case, it seems to be a male who remained pure from sexual encounters as well. So both males and females. We do know that in the early church, they did exalt celibacy. Even Jesus spoke and seemed to approve of it. If you went to Matthew chapter 19, verse 12, it came as an extreme by the Marcions in the second century. They had established actually a church of celibates. They probably were not having a whole lot of baby dedications there. Origen took it one step further and castrated himself in order to ensure chastity. So I don't know if you need to go that far, but there is a purpose and reason for people to remain, for some people to remain single. It's just the way it is, but there's also not a reason as well. It's kind of your own individual person of who you are. So as you can imagine, there are some holes in this idea, since it implies that sexual relations within marriage was defiling, which is contrary to the teachings of the New Testament. We also know from Genesis 2 that God made male and female for each other. So where exactly is this going? We could take a figurative stance and look at the 144,000 as those who kept themselves away from adultery and fornication of, say, with idol priests and priestesses, that sort of thing, outside of marriage, or temple prostitutes. Maybe there is a more of a sexual purity. I hate using that word now because it's been kind of defiled with the purity culture. But anyways, I think that's part of, we could look at this from more of a figurative way. So there are virgins as in if they never entered into immoral relations with the other sex or the same sex. I would think based on the context, he is more right about sexual encounters with temple prostitutes, such as what we saw in Ephesus with Artemis, as well as other forms of cult prostitution. We do know, and you could also think that, I would imagine, I would not be surprised knowing the Romans, that there was a lot of prostitution and inappropriate sexual encounters at the temples that were created for imperial worship as well. So that's probably part of this, I would think. We do know that chastity was highly regarded in the early church, but it did not elevate those who practiced it to be the only ones to be redeemed. So just because you remain chaste did not mean that you would be some higher level plane, put at a different level than somebody else. Because we love it, let's stay on the virgin concept for a little more and look at it from the Old Testament perspective, where Israel was referred to as a virgin, such as in 2 Kings 19:21, as well as in other areas and the prophets. You see this. The idea is brought into, like I mentioned before, with Paul when he offers up the church or individuals in the church to one husband, to the Christ. So the 144,000 here are those who have kept themselves pure, waiting to be offered up to Christ. They have not defiled themselves with relationships within the pagan world system. So we're just kind of coming a little bit closer to everything else that John is talking about. And we're not just trying to pick this apart and take a single verse and take it out of context. But you see a weaving of a story that John is trying to say within the pagan world system in which they existed. And even for us in many ways do. You could say even further that they've resisted the seduction of Rome. So with all of this, there should be no confusion of the sexes, as all of this was to be read symbolically. We then see the redeemed as those who follow the Lamb. The following points to have the redeemed follow the life and instruction of Jesus while he was on earth, is living and as an example, is probably what we're seeing here as well. The reference of first fruits, originally, of course, first fruits meant a token offering to God that released the harvest that followed, of course, eating at that point. So you've offered up and as a thanksgiving to God of what you have been provided, and then, of course, consume it after that, hopefully a reasonable and responsible manner. The point of reference here is that by offering themselves to God, they were set free from human entanglements and instead to belong solely to him. So they have stayed away from the seduction of Rome and the pagan systems, world systems, and have offered them fully and completely to God. As we turn into verse 5, it's actually page 1190 in my Bible. This is a contrast to those who have sold out to the Antichrist, the ones who live and practice the falsehoods. The pagan world exchanged the truth for a lie, but that is not the case with those who are redeemed. Zephaniah had prophesied that the remnant of Israel would speak no lies, nor would deceit be found in their mouths, and the 144,000 were also ethically blameless. They were beyond the reach of blame. So that's what we're seeing with this related to the blameless. They had avoided the pagan systems. As we wrap up this section, we have the contrast with the two very scary beasts with the hope of the Lamb, which of course, as you can imagine, brings a surge of spirited expectation. And as difficult as the future may be, there remains a joyful prospect of soon to be standing beyond the suffering. The people will soon be standing beyond the suffering and being with the redeemed and singing the song of salvation, which of course is to strengthen the believer to endure the reality in which they existed. Again, today we can look at the book of Revelation for the very, very same reason, to be able to look at it from that perspective of hope and to strengthen us and allow us to endure a sometimes seemingly crazy world. All right. The next section encompasses 6 through 20, but we're only going to go through 13 today because, we only have so much time per day to do this great work. And so we're going to, let me read chapter 14, verses 6 through 13, and then we'll do a quick overview of those verses, and we'll go on from there. We have entered here, as we read this, you'll notice another interlude, much like what we saw in chapter 7 between the sounding of the sixth and seventh trumpet. Here, after the vision of the heavenly vision of the 144,000 on Mount Zion, we see the reader will be reminded of those who believe will be redeemed, while judgment will come to those in the unbelieving world. This also allows us to go back to the martyrs that we see in chapter 6, verses 9 through 11, that God has not forgotten about them and the violent death they face because of their faithfulness and their conviction of what they believed. So we have the impending judgment is announced here. We now leave the vision of the Lamb, and we have the 44,000 standing in victory on Mount Zion, and introduced now to three angels who come with a message that, as you'll notice, are very much tied together and progressive as they go. We have the summons to worship the Creator. We have the prediction of the downfall of the citadel of paganism or pagan systems, and a portrayal of all who will be tormented for worshiping the beast. So, it almost seems like I'm avoiding reading verses 6 through 13, and I'm not. And that's why we will begin right now. So, chapter 14, verse 6 through 13. And I saw another angel flying in, another angel. Keep that in mind, because that's important. Mid-heaven, or mid-air. Having an eternal gospel to preach to those who live on the earth and to every nation and tribe and tongue and people. And he said with a loud voice, "Fear God and give him glory, because the hour of his judgment has come. Worship him who made the heaven and the earth and sea and the springs of water." Notice the contrast of the waters. Salt water, sea, and springs of water, fresh. And another angel, a second one, followed, saying, "Fallen, fallen is Babylon the Great. Rome, she who has made all the nations drink of the wine of the passion of her immorality." Verse 9, then another angel, third one, followed them, saying with a loud voice, "If anyone worships the beast in his image and receives a mark on his forehead or his hand, he also will drink of the wine of the wrath of God, and which is mixed in full strength in the cup of his anger, and he will be tormented with fire and brimstone in the presence of the holy angels and in the presence of the Lamb," as in they will be looking on. "And the smoke of their torment goes up forever and ever." Oh boy. "They have no rest day and night, those who worship the beast in his image and whoever receives the mark of his name. Here is the perseverance of the saints who keep the commandments of God and their faith in Jesus. And I heard a voice from heaven saying, write." That's important. It is important because this needs to get written down. "Blessed are the dead who die in the Lord from now on. Yes, says the Spirit, so that they may rest for their labors, for their deeds follow with them." This is just nut show. This is all I gotta say. This is how this is all gonna play out. We have three new angels we haven't met before. At least we don't think we've met them before, based on the information that we're provided. It doesn't say the angel returned or the angel from earlier on, the angel who let the people out of the abyss or let the demons out of the abyss. We don't get any of that. So we have three new angels that we get to meet with and interact with. I don't think they're archangels. I think it would have said if they were a different. I don't know. Anyways, speculate all day long. We're not, like I said, not sure exactly who this angel is referred to, but most likely all the other angels who we've already met, just another angel. It is similar to the eagle of woe from chapter 8, verse 13, which flies and speaks in a way where everyone can hear living on earth based on them flying around in mid-heaven or mid-earth. We are mid-air. We are introduced to the eternal gospel. This is not the gospel of God's redeeming grace, but another one. Tied to the summons to fear, honor, and worship God, the Creator. So it's a little bit different. So gospel, of course, means good news or news, providing of news, the provision of news. And so this is good news for those who fear and honor and worship God. We can look at also the eternal gospel as being the announcement of the end of history of humankind, which to a point is good news because God... it's redemption of not only the people, but of heaven and earth. So it's a pretty good deal. And it can also be used as a way to set eternal direction of God's people. it is for the judgment and salvation of all people who are residing on earth, is what we're seeing with this. Verse 7, the hour of judgment is at hand. So all must fear and honor God. We know that God has revealed himself in nature in all ways so that people are without excuse about knowing God, as we see in Romans 1:19-20. God reveals himself in many ways, in ways that we cannot comprehend. So we cannot, I don't like to be honest, too judgy about people who are not seemingly Christians, because, or people who don't live in Christian countries or that have the culture of Christianity in their country. Because I think God reveals in many ways, and what that looks like is God can do whatever he wants in that regard. So the people are to give God glory and to pay the respect to God, which is due, for the most part, of course, to show reverence to God. Though many have turned away and failed to glorify God, they have one last chance to repent and to glorify God. People are naturally made to worship the God of all creation, to worship the God through the heavens, earth, and the waters. Similar to what we see in Acts 14 through 15, chapter 14, verse 15, turn from these worthless things to the living God who made heaven and earth and sea and everything in them. We learn about another angel here, number two, Angel Sue, also flying around in midair. This angel announces the fall of Babylon the Great. Since there is no introduction to this symbolic reference, it is assumed that the people reading would know what he or it was referring to. We don't know the... So for the early church, the city of Rome was the contemporary Babylon. So they, to them and to us, understanding from historical context is that he is referring to Babylon. Everyone knew what Babylon was. At one point was, of course, the religious and political capital of the world. It was known for its moral corruption and luxurious living, and it was also known to be a great enemy of the people of God. And of course, remember Nebuchadnezzar from Daniel chapter 4. It was known to lure people away from God and worship of the Creator. Think of it as a dark Jerusalem, the anti-Jerusalem, the final manifestation, most likely, of secular humanism, removing or attempting to destroy all remaining vestiges of religion, is what's going on here. So, pretty bad stuff. So, the angel announces the center of pagan power and the name. In the same way as Isaiah does in Isaiah chapter 21, Babylon has fallen. Quite dramatic. I bet he was a pretty dramatic guy. Probably still is. The next reference is to Jeremiah 5:27, with the mention of the gold cup, which made all the world drunk. The nations had drunk the wine, making them go mad in their pagan ways. Depending on your translation, you'll either see wrath or passion of her sexual immorality. Using the word wrath could be the final irrevocable judgment of God. What we can take from this is that the angel is possibly pointing out the heady position of Rome's seductive practices and how they would seduce the people of the world. And eventually, this seductive practice will lead to the end, or the wrath, not the end, but the lead to the wrath of God. Think of it as a wine that brings God's anger. From verses 9 through 11... Of course, verses 9 through 10 first, and then 2:11. Wow, this is going fast. We have a counterpunch or proclamation to those who would not worship the image of the beast, who would not be able to buy or sell if they did not worship the image of the beast. We now get the third angel countering that view. Now there's a much worse fate for those who want to worship the beast and bear the mark of the beast. They themselves will also drink the wrath of God's fury and endure eternal torment. The warning not only goes to all pagans, but also the folks in the Christian community who will deny their faith when they are persecuted. So, pretty severe. In verses 12 and 13, we'll further explain, for the most part, the fate of the apostate Christians. Those who continue to worship the beast will face the wrath of God. We see references to how offerings of wine to enemy nations causes the fall of the nations, such as Jeremiah 25, where the nations who are given the wrath of God shall stagger and go mad, get drunk, vomit, and rise no more. So, again, John is pulling references from our friends in the prophets. God's wrath is righteous based on what we're seeing here, and based on a people's adamant refusal to accept his love. This is not about following some rules or laws. The wrath is passionate and vehement. Vehement? Yeah. the word that's actually being used here in the original text or in Greek would have been thunos, meaning that it is the white heat of God's anger. So it's pretty, pretty bad. Very, very bad. The use of full strength is telling us that there is no dilution to this wine. There's, as in, there is no mercy and no grace. Those options are now gone. They had their chance. They turned away from it. The uses of sulfur points to the judgment on Sodom and Gomorrah. We know sulfur was used in that instance. And, of course, we'll see will be used repeatedly in the final chapters of Revelation. Sulfur is a very apocalyptic symbol here, but yet we should not take it lightly. The readers here were to be startled into seeing the eternal consequences of denying their faith in God and what that would look like. Though it may feel a bit hyperbolic, it is not the time to dwell on that thought, and it seems that judgment will take place in the presence of the Lamb and the holy angels. Like I said, they'll be looking on. I believe this judgment is looking to Luke chapter 12, verse 9, where Jesus says that those who disown him will be disowned before the angels of God. This punishment is in front of the holy host, which is apparently to make the punishment even more severe, which is a Jewish tradition. It was very much a Jewish belief that those who have denied God, those who have been damned, will be punished in the presence of those who are or remain righteous. So again, pointing back to his Jewish heritage, they seem to believe that this made sense based on all the pain and suffering the righteous had to go through. So now those who are being tormented can go through pain and suffering in front of those who were tormented. It is to show a comparison between, as Second Esdras discuss, the place of refreshment with the pit of torment and the paradise of delight versus the furnace of Gehenna. For those who are under judgment, to look on at that, to look on at the righteous and see the drastic differences in their situation, fire and torment compared to delight and refreshment. Let's not drag this along too much, but that's what is going on here, is that the contrast between the two. With all that said, there's nothing, those are all kind of speculations that John was saying, because there's nothing specific or explicit said in Revelation that this is what's going to happen. That the angels and the elders will, but those who are righteous will not. There's nothing that says that. So let's just finish up there. Verse 11. We are learning here that those who choose evil over righteousness should expect eternal torment. The use of eternal is similar to that of the four living creatures, eternal worship in chapter 4, verse 8. Some may disagree with the idea of hell being offensive. Well, they may disagree with this idea because they think that the idea of hell is offensive. Probably a better way to say it. Which hell is what we are dealing with here. As people who willfully reject the love of God, eternal punishment is the outcome. So you have... As we see here, we've seen in the prophets, we've seen in Revelation, there's multiple times that God will reveal, give opportunities in many different ways, like in natural ways, in non-natural ways, in ways that we can't comprehend this opportunity. So you have to willfully reject God. Jesus spoke of hell as a reality for those who reject the love of God, like what we see in Luke 16. Where they learn the story of the rich man and Lazarus, where the rich man, of course, goes to Gehenna, and the Lazarus goes to the happy place, and you see, or the good place, and you see the story of that. What we're seeing is this terrifying reality of divine wrath poured out upon those who persist in following the Antichrist. Though it is tempting, we cannot dilute what the angel is saying with well-intentioned euphemisms. And I am one who likes well-intentioned euphemisms when it comes to hell, and it doesn't seem like we can get away with that here. Verse 12. This verse is a comment by the one seeing the vision tied to the angel's proclamation of the divine wrath, telling us that if this is the fate of those who deny God, the people of God must at all costs keep their faith in Christ. They cannot give up. They must endure the sufferings and trials that come from not worshiping the Roman emperor. The demands of the imperial cult and the threat of capital punishment from 13:5 can be a crucial test to the believer's loyalty. So they must hold on strongly to what they believe. As we've discussed, rejection of the worship of the emperor could lead to a bloodbath. to martyrdom of those who will not profess. We contrast this with the apostasy can lead to eternal torment, as we see in verses 9 and 11. So suffer in the short term, it's one of those things. So it is with the saints who are to obey the revelation of God and continue to have their faith in Jesus is the hope of all this. Verse 13. The final verse that we will be doing today, we have the seer who now hears a voice from heaven, from which, for the most part, tells us that their faithfulness in Christ may lead to martyrdom, but those who die are blessed as they have entered victoriously into rest. So death is not the end, but a transition from the temporal to what is final. Hard enough it is the Holy Spirit speaking here, as the Holy Spirit seems to be speaking in the latter part of this verse. What it is our understanding is that the voice that is speaking obviously has some sort of high level of divine authority. We're commanded to write. We know, of course, what is to be saying is important. When you see that, write this down. Isn't that a George Strait song? Write this down. Yeah, so that's very important then too. We have to look at this also as a beatitude. One of seven that are actually found in Revelation. Blessed are those who meet death in the state of spiritual union with Christ. This is to contrast the apostates who have walked away from Jesus and have not kept in spiritual union with Christ. For those who have turned away or always remain pagans, they will face eternal judgment and loss. The use of from now on has made some believe that those who die a martyrdom will have a special blessedness, setting them apart from other believers. I don't think that's really where that's going from here. Instead, we are to look at this from now on. Life will be a lot harder as a transition into a life of persecution. Yeah, I think that's probably based on John's writings. That makes a lot more sense. In this view, they are not being set apart from those believers who died in less trying circumstances. All believers coming to the redemption of God on equal footing. Their deeds, God will not forget that they endured loyally to the faith, that they resisted the demands of the Antichrist. So all that will be remembered. Deeds here is not a spiritual attitude or even an inward character. This is not a legalistic work that merits eternal bliss, but a manifestation of their devotion to Christ. So the deeds are their devotion, how they are remained faithful. And these deeds follow them in the sense that there can be no separation between what a person is and what a person does. And so that's the faithfulness of who we are within ourselves, the spiritual people that we are, and our consistencies with that of being followers of Christ, being faithful and righteous in Christ. So that's it. All right. Next week, look at that. It'll be 14:14 is where we'll start. And we'll finish up. That's only six verses to get rid of that. And then we'll do all of chapter 15 next week. Oh, man, that's still not a lot. And we may even jump into chapter 16. This could be just a big, big thing, a big time of it. So I hope you have a good rest of your day. Thank you very much.
We hope you have enjoyed the podcast. For more information about our church, visit www.woodridge.org.